session number 10883, Reel 5.
Michael Rondry, Reel 5.
I think it was while we were in Tripolitania or Tunisia that a section of the Friends Ambulance Unit under Hamilton Mills left to join another division of the Free French under General Leclerc. And they went off to and started another section, which eventually had some quite interesting times in with their division, but I can't speak from personal experience there. We in Tunisia remained until we left for Italy in April, I think, of 1944, when the first Free French Division, our division, was sent across to Italy, and we embarked from Bizerta and took all our lorries and our tents and everything, and landed at Naples in May 1944.
During your time in the Western Desert, were you in touch with the FAU back in the UK? Did you have any communication?
Oh, yes. Postal services were perfectly all right, and we could get regular communications by post through the ordinary postal services, which were run by the Army, of course, and we had things called aerograms, which were reduced forms of air letters, which were photographed and reduced, and we could get messages through official channels from Gordon Square, but we could communicate with both our headquarters at Gordon Square on operational matters and with our families at home. There was no problem about that. I think the communications really were fairly good on the whole most of the time.
And how had you stood up to the responsibility of section leader? Did you find it a very sort of onerous task?
Well, it's for others to say how I worked. I don't recall it being onerous the whole time. There were difficulties, eased, as I say, by the fact that Colonel Fruchot was replaced by Colonel Vernier, who was a very much more human and easy person to get on with. Relations with Lady Spears were never altogether smooth running. She had very much her own ideas, and although I think she became personally quite fond of some of us, she obviously had little sympathy for our position. So that we were in a fairly delicate and uncertain role, and obviously being a pacifist in a war situation creates its own tensions. I suppose on the whole I must have stood up to it reasonably well in the fact that I enjoyed my time so much, and that was very largely due to the forbearance and tolerance of others. And I think on the whole, the French, considering how little they understood of our position, put up with us very well, especially as, in some sense, we were taking some of the more interesting jobs from them, which they might well have felt that they could have done themselves. When the Hadfield Spears was first set up in Britain in 1940, the small Free French unit which had come to Britain was short of personnel with any kind of skills at all, and were glad to take anyone with some kind of the kind of skills, even the minimal kind of skills that we could offer. As the war went on, and this applied perhaps not so much in the desert, but certainly as we moved into France, they got more and more personnel, French personnel, coming to them, and they could easily take over some of the jobs that we were doing. And later on, there were some strains set up as a result of that. But basically, our relations were pretty harmonious, and as I say, I think owe a lot to the tolerance both of the French authorities and indeed of the British authorities, because we had to deal quite a lot with them when we were in the desert and ultimately under British command. we landed in Italy in May 1944 at Naples, and fairly immediately went to a place called San Clemente when the Free French Division was, along with others, was attacking the German positions at Monte Cassino. And we had a very busy time there. We were close to the front, and there were a great many casualties. This was one of the occasions when the hospital was actually shelled, not with any damage or casualties in the hospital, but it did mean, I think, that, for instance, there was an operation going on at the time, and I think the surgeon had to put the patient on the floor to continue the operation. We were lucky to get away without any casualties. So there was a busy time there when we were in San Clemente. Thereafter, for the time we were in Italy, we weren't particularly busy. The Free French was moved up to the north, but there wasn't, as I recall, a tremendous amount of fighting. And we were in Italy, I suppose, until about August, when the landing in the south of France took place. And this, of course, was an enormous event for the French, because it was the first time they were going to get back into their home territory. We woke up one morning in Italy to discover that Colonel Vernier and one or two of the French and two of our FAU members and two of the women had disappeared without anybody being told about this. And they had, in fact, taken part in a commando landing in the south of France as part of the original landings on the south coast of France. It caused some ruffled feelings, particularly among the French, who felt that they should have known about it. But I suppose that Colonel Vernier was in a difficult position because he'd obviously been under an oath of secrecy about it, and nobody knew anything about it. We followed with the main landing a little time later, after the landing had taken place in France, and we landed at Fréjus, and then spent some time searching for our missing colonel and the forward unit. We moved northward up the Rhone Valley and eventually met up with them again somewhere between Vals-les-Bains and Dijon, I think it was. Thereafter, we moved up beyond Lyon and into the area towards the Swiss frontier, and then were suddenly switched across to the southwest of France, to the Atlantic coast, where there was a small pocket of Germans ensconced at Rouen and the mouth of the Gironde, and the division was sent across to deal with them. This was when we started leave for our personnel, just at this time, so I missed a good deal of the operation down there because I was on leave at home for the first time since 1941. But the reception that the French had when they got to France was, of course, quite remarkable, and as being part of the French division, we all shared in this and were showered with fruit and flowers and kisses and everything else as we moved forward from place to place. It was a very emotional time for the French, getting back to France after 4 or 5 years' absence, and in many cases, of course, finding great change among their families with whom they hadn't been able to be in touch for the whole of the period of the occupation, and several of them found that their families, members of their families, had died or been killed while they were away. So it was a very moving time. From the southwest coast, the hospital was the division was then moved back into the Vosges. In snowy conditions in the middle of winter, and we were stationed for a while in a hotel up in the Vosges Mountains, where there was a certain amount of fighting going on. And then from there, we were moved down to the Riviera. And I ended the war, oddly enough, living in a rather smart hotel at Beaulieu on the Riviera, where the hospital was established, with a forward unit up one of the valleys inland from the coast. This seemed to us to be a particularly tragic time, because as May came along, it was perfectly obvious to all concerned that the war was going to end within a matter of days. But for political reasons, the French found it necessary to attack a very strong Italian position in the mountains in order to try and get into Italian territory to hold as a bargaining counter when peace came. And they had as many casualties in that last week of the war as in many of the major battles that they'd taken part in during the rest of the war. And it was heartbreaking to be in conditions of considerable luxury in a Riviera hotel and have all these casualties coming in from the front when everybody knew that the war was going to end within a week, as indeed it did. And this we all found extremely hard to take and a really terrible example of how political expediency can have an impact on the lives and deaths of men.
I was wondering also, you know, you were saying about the excitement of the French getting back to their homeland. Were there any unpleasant aspects that you noticed?
A good deal of retribution did go on, I think. I don't recall personally seeing anything of a particularly unpleasant nature, possibly partly because going in from the south, we were going into unoccupied France rather than occupied France, which was the north. And therefore, though many horrible things undoubtedly happened there, it hadn't been quite as bad as the situation further north. There was a lot of expressions of hate and ill feeling, very naturally, on the part of our French colleagues. And one certainly heard of some fairly unpleasant things being done to collaborationists particularly. I don't recall having actually personally witnessed any of this myself.
Did you have any contact with friends? Were there French friends in the areas you went through?
There are very, very few Quakers, French Quakers, and we didn't come across any at the time that we were going into France. The only time I did come across one or two was later on after the end of the war when we did meet one or two friends in Paris, but that was after the end of the war.
How had they fared, you know, during the war because of their attitudes to, you know, non-partisan and pacifism? I was wondering with the French population whether there was any problem for them.
I really can't say, I'm afraid. I don't know whether they fared any better or worse at the hands of the Germans. At the hands of the French, on the grounds that they might have been thought to be collaborators, it's possible that one or two of them did incur any odium, but I have no actual knowledge of this and certainly can't quote any individual cases, I'm afraid.
I noticed when you filled in our form, under medals you put the Croix de Guerre. This sounds quite a paradox.
Well, it is indeed, and I did have considerable hesitations, and we did in fact have some discussion as to whether or not it was appropriate for me to accept it. I did in the end, on the grounds that it wasn't personal to me by any means. It was given to me as leader of the section as a recognition and appreciation of what the FAU had done during 4 years with the Free French Division. And because we had this very close and warm feeling with the members of the Free French Division, quite apart from our own colleagues in the hospital itself, with whom we were on very close terms, we did as a section, I think, feel that it would have been churlish to have turned it down when offered to me. So I did, in fact, accept it, though I'm afraid I've never used it since, and I've only regarded it as an expression of gratitude on the part of the French for what the FAU had been able to do in the Hadfield Spears. But I agree, it is anomalous and slightly embarrassing, actually, for a conscientious objector to say that he's got a quite a gear.
You had a very active war there, Michael, didn't you?
Yes, an active and an extremely interesting war, and of course I was extremely fortunate to have been in a position to have that, and very privileged to have that kind of a war.
Do you find that, you know, you've explained your doubts from time to time during the war about your pacifism, but being in a situation of war and seeing the casualties and the devastation, the refugees, how do you think it affected your pacifism? You know, did you emerge at the end of the war still a pacifist, a convinced pacifist?
I think so, yes. I suppose that one's Quaker upbringing goes very deep, and a belief that the pacifist way, difficult as it is the way that one ought to be aiming at. But you've mentioned the doubts I have and had, and certainly I wasn't alone in that. And I think that all of us must have had doubts at many times during the war. As you've said, we saw all these casualties coming in. Some of them were acquaintances and friends of ours, and we're not any of us immune from feelings of hatred and a desire desire for revenge. And I'm bound to say, I couldn't say with any certainty now how I would react if I was 20 now instead of 70, if the same situation arose again. I think I still ended the war probably a pacifist, not so much on a theoretical basis, or indeed a doctrinal basis perhaps, as a desire to be able to help to heal the wounds of war more than to create them, but recognizing that it's a great privilege to be able to be in that position, which no doubt many people who felt it right to go into the services would have greatly preferred to be able to do, but were not able to do so. So, doubts, yes. Guilt, certainly, yes. I think that I was fairly guilt-ridden throughout most of the war, probably, feeling that I was in a very privileged position, and wondering, therefore, whether it really was right to go on accepting that privileged position, though not in the end, I think, doubting that I was right to do what I had done at the outbreak of war, and continuing to accept that position throughout the war. I think every time one heard of members of the unit taking the other road and feeling they had to join up, obviously it did bring to the fore the kind of doubts and guilt that one felt. And we did have many quite long discussions at different times within the section during the war as to whether we were right to be doing it and what we ought to do in the future.
Did you also hold meetings, you know, your Quaker meetings?
We did. Not every day. Certainly we would try at least once a week to hold them, and on Sundays when possible, and sometimes at odd times, particularly in moments of stress. We would try to set aside short periods for meetings for worship. It wasn't always possible, but I think those of us particularly who had grown up as friends felt that this was a necessary part of our witness, and we needed it to strengthen our own position. Not all the members of the FAU were Quakers, and not all the members of our particular section were Quakers, but I think all of them felt that they drew inspiration from a meeting for worship held in the way that we did. We felt we lacked guidance and ministry and people who were able to help us in our meetings for worship, because we were all fairly young, of course, for most of the war, most of us in our early 20s, and often felt that we lacked the spiritual experience to be able to conduct a gathered meeting as it should have been done. But we struggled on, and we got guidance, I hope, from the power from God within the meeting, and certainly I think that we benefited from it, and it strengthened our position.
You must have had your meetings in very unusual settings.
Very odd settings, yes. Indoors, outdoors, sitting in the backs of trucks, all sorts of places. Of course, climatically, as we were in Mediterranean climate for so much of the war, a good many of them were held outside in the open. But in most of the places we were, we had a common room of some kind for our section. It might have been one of the tents or a room when we were in a building, and we would very often be able to use that common room for meeting. But we did have them in the backs of lorries and sitting under palm trees and all sorts of odd places, and with the sounds and sights of war going on in the background, of course, which in some cases made them additionally poignant, but additionally relevant.
You know, you were saying about the lack of guidance, that you didn't have any elders with you. And as a unit as well, you were all very young, weren't you?
Yes.
You know, did you find at times the responsibility was rather daunting, or did you appreciate the fact that you were given independence?
Well, both, really. Yes, I certainly found the responsibility daunting at times. One had to make snap decisions sometimes, and one was responsible for 20 or 30 people. But equally, we were given a good deal of independence, and to that extent, we were very privileged, of course, and I think we all recognised that we were privileged. We weren't subjected to the necessary rigours of military discipline. We didn't have to accept automatically orders that came on from on high in the way that somebody within the services would have to do. We were very fortunate, but it did cast a lot of responsibility on us to act responsibly, and one certainly did have to take difficult decisions at times.
Did the strain tell, you know, on certain members? Did you have any problems that you had to continue with?
Surprisingly little, I think. Thinking back, I can't think of any psychiatric problems that we had among any of our members. I mean, some would have said that some of us were psychiatric problems from the from the very start and never lost it. But on the whole, I think people bore up against the situation remarkably well, thinking back. We never had to hospitalise anyone, or indeed, that I can recall, refer anyone for medical treatment on psychiatric or emotional grounds. Now you've mentioned that, it is rather surprising, perhaps, that that one didn't have more cases of that kind. I don't know. I suppose having a strong belief or a faith may insulate you to some extent from the kinds of stresses that people without any beliefs of strong beliefs of that kind might have. On the other hand, one might well feel that in some cases it imposes a greater burden, that people with perhaps less sensitive consciences may not agonize so much as those with doubts do, and therefore perhaps to that extent rather less subjected to psychological strains.
You must have seen some pretty awful sights, you know, with severe casualties. I was thinking of in the desert, one hears so much of burns, you know, the type of burns. Did you find that was upsetting, you know, from your own point of view, getting used to that sort of thing?
Yes, one certainly, anyone in a war situation, or indeed in a civilian situation, bombing at home, certainly sees some extremely unpleasant sights, dismembered limbs, burns, people burnt to death in tanks, this kind of thing. It isn't the kind of thing that I've dwelt on particularly since the war, so to that extent I must have managed to anaesthetize it, and I don't remember it being a major problem during the war. I don't know why it wasn't, because I'm as squeamish as the next person, and certainly don't relish even now looking on dismembered animals and this kind of thing, of which one saw quite a lot of that, for instance, in areas where horse transport was still used, as in the days of the Great War, when you used to see quite a lot of dead horses beside the road, one of which was incorporated into one of our many unit Anglo-French Spears songs, something about the smell of rotting horses beside the road. I suppose one got adapted to it. I can still recall one or two cases of dismembered bodies. Can you take it off a minute now?